from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Politics in Theory and Practice, this week on Soundings. First, a conversation with James Booth of Duke University about his study of the political theories of Karl Marx. Following that, a discussion with Charles Kessler of Claremont McKenna College about the Federalist Papers and the founding of the American Republic. James Booth, one of the things that you're looking at in this study you're doing of Marx and Marxism is the question of justice. And you say that Marx dismissed the question of justice as a pivotal social issue. Why is that?
I should say, first of all, that this question is very much in dispute amongst Marx commentators. There are commentators who claim to have found in certain of Marx's works, particularly the Critique of the Agatha Program, a theory of justice. To put it in brief, Marx's notion of justice in socialist society is that each person will receive rewards in proportion to the labor that he contributes to society. Justice in communist society, according to this interpretation of Marx, draws on Marx's famous banderole, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, which is the principle of distributive justice, allegedly, in communist society. Those who claim that Marx didn't have a theory of justice draw on a number of arguments. One, which we might call Marx's sociology of knowledge, which is that ideas are ultimately rooted in the economic circumstances and class structure of their time. Hence, any particular conception of justice is going to represent the views of a given class. And it follows from this that it's impossible to find a superhistorical principle of justice. Every society will generate a theory of justice about itself, which will be a mere reflection of its underlying economic and class structure. Hence, according to this argument, it's impossible to discover in Marx an overarching theory of justice which could be used to criticize capitalism. A second line of interpretation, which drives to the same conclusion, namely that Marx didn't have a theory of justice, is that Marx, in his economic writings, regularly speaks about the fairness of capitalism. That is, he describes, for example, the contractual exchanges between worker and capitalists as being essentially fair. What he means by fair is fair according to the laws of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. That is, each receives value, the one for his labor power, the other for the capital that he provides.
And what side of the question do you fall on, James Booth? I mean, did or did not Marx believe in justice? Are you second-guessing him, or are you uncomfortable about that?
let me point out the fundamental... Yes, in a way, we are second-guessing him. The claim has been made, for example, by Professor John Elster at Chicago, that Marx had a theory of justice despite himself. Elster's argument, Elster says, is that it's impossible to read Marx's writings without sensing the moral passion which infused his critique of capitalism, despite its claims to be a quote-unquote scientific account of the laws of motion of the capitalist economy, and that one finds in Marx's repeated references to wage slavery, for example, or to capitalism as theft, one finds the rudiments, at least, of a theory of justice, even if Marx himself was reluctant to espouse such a theory. I personally tend to think that Marx did not have a theory of justice, but for rather different reasons than those which I've just outlined. In his famous essay, The Jewish Question, which was written in 1843, Marx examines political justice in the United States. He wants to take the United States as an exemplar of the most developed, the most perfected form of the state, namely the liberal, secular, democratic state. Marx's argument, in essence, in the second part of The Jewish Question, is that even with its political accomplishments, liberalism has failed to discover or to unveil the true master of capitalist society. That true master is to be found in the underlying economic system, so that according to Marx, what you see in liberal democratic societies in their most perfect form is a notion of freedom, equality, and independence of citizens at the political level without regard to what goes on at the fundamental or underlying economic sphere. Marx's account then tends to turn from the political question, namely, what is justice, to the what he believed to be the underlying issue, namely, what is the structure of domination in the economy? Insofar as liberalism had ignored, according to Marx, that underlying question, it had missed the existence of another form of mastery other than political mastery, which liberalism claimed to be an answer to.
Mm-hmm. What would he have made of capitalist structures today? Been as critical, not as critical, on what grounds?
Yes, I don't believe that his criticism would be fundamentally altered were he to come back today and observe capitalism. The economic processes which Marx outlined in the three volumes of Capital would, in his view, I suspect, be fundamentally unchanged in 20th century. Well, I mean, there are, of course, significant economic changes, but none which, in Marx's account of things, would touch the basic critique of capitalism, namely the extraction of a surplus from the working population. That form of exploitation, which Marx believed he had identified as the centerpiece of the capitalist economy, this would, in his view, I suspect, still exist. So were he to come back today and see, for example, that workers are earning significantly more than they were in the Dickensian world of 19th century England, that working conditions are improved, that workers, instead of working 18 hours a day in factories hovering over the satanic spinning jennies, instead of doing this, they work 4 days a week and drive large cars. This, in Marx's view, the amount of wealth available to the working population, the size of their wage package, was never the essential question. Exploitation, in his view, was consistent with a fairly high level of wages, fairly high living standards.
Regardless of the cosmetics.
Regardless. I mean, he would view it as cosmetics or as changes, but changes which, in any case, didn't touch the basic nature of capital society, which is to extract a surplus from the sale of the labor power of the working population.
Mm-hmm. James Booth, I want you to speculate for me for a moment and be specific. What might Marx make of the uses and abuses to which his name has been put, for example, with respect to life in the Soviet Union?
Yes. It's somewhat difficult to say, largely because Marx avoided discussions of communist society or transition to communist society. Nevertheless, in the few passages in which he did discuss such matters, there is a sense in Marx in which repression would be necessary in the period of transformation. Repression designed, on the one hand, to eliminate the political power of the capitalist class, and of course, more importantly for Marx, also to eliminate their economic power. That means, in short, the expropriation of the capitalist class, the liberating from them, in Marx's view, of the means of production. So Marx, while not an explicit advocate of a repressive system, nevertheless saw a use for repression, at least in the transition period from capitalism to communism. If one probes somewhat more deeply into the philosophical bases of Marxism, some of which we've already discussed, namely the rejection of theories of justice and of rights, and the broad brush critique of democratic political institutions and free enterprise in the economic sphere, it isn't hard to see how Soviet theorists, beginning with Lenin, could see in Marx's writings justification or legitimation of their own practices. Nevertheless, it's important to say that Marx nowhere envisaged the sort of state dictatorship, permanent state dictatorship, that we see in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Indeed, one contemporary commentator on Marx, Leszek Kolakowski of the University of Chicago, has referred to the Polish Solidarity Uprising, for example, as the first genuine workers' revolution that is attempting to expropriate the means of production from their new owners, namely the Polish Workers' Party and the state.
That is a bit of an irony, isn't it?
Yes, indeed, it's an irony, and it's a rich one, perhaps, for the Soviet leadership. So it's with some trepidation that one would try to draw a direct deductive path or line from Marx's writings to present political conditions in the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, Marx's, as we've just mentioned, Marx's ambivalence or rejection of issues of right, of theories of justice, and his fundamental critique of liberal democracy perhaps provided some of the intellectual inspiration for his followers in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to call him a utopian thinker?
Marx had nothing but scorn for utopian thinking. He rejected past socialists largely because of his socialist precursors, largely because of the utopian character of their writings. Nevertheless, in certain places in Marx's writings, for example, the very end of Volume 3 of Capital, the critique of the Gotha Program, which we've already discussed briefly, and in some of his early writings, the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts of 1844, one does find a certain utopian strand in Marx, namely a description of a society in which individuals will be free of economic pressure and in which the community will be, in Marx's famous words, a free association of producers. He was loath to discuss these ideas in detail, believing, as he said in one of his 1843 journalistic pieces, that the important point is to criticize the present and that out of the criticism of the present may emerge a picture of the society to come. There is perhaps a broader utopian current in Marx's thought, and that is the notion of history is driving determinately towards a single and final outcome, namely the creation of communist society. Marx believed that that was a fixed point, one which was unavoidable and which would indeed be superior to capitalism, though, to repeat what we said before, it's difficult to see in what sense Marx could hold a theory of the moral superiority or superiority in point of view of justice of communist society, given the fact that he had developed a critique of the possibility of such normative accounts.
Mm-hmm. James Booth, what particular spin are you putting on Marx? What is it that's new or even unique in what you were saying that hasn't necessarily been said before? Help me to understand that.
Yes. My argument is that the central concern for Marx is not an issue of distributive justice and is not economic egalitarianism, which I think would be the fairly common spin that would be put on Marxism, that is that Marx wanted a equal distribution of assets in society. Rather, my argument is that Marx's principal concern was with domination or the master-servant relationship. Marx's critique of liberalism was that it too had addressed master-servant relation, understood in the liberal view as relations between human beings and between human beings and their governments. In Marx's famous phrase from the German ideology, he says, the violence of things has replaced the violence of men. Hmm. What he means is that the violence of men, namely, for example, lord-vassal relations in the feudal world, that this indeed has been transformed by the free, independent, and equal individuals of liberal political philosophy. That form of domination no longer exists, but a new master has emerged, namely, the laws of motion of the capitalist economy. The solution, therefore, ultimately is, as Marx says, the conscious control of the means of production, that is, for the community to reappropriate to itself control over its own economic life.
James Booth teaches at Duke University. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a study of the political theories of Karl Marx. James Booth is the author of Interpreting the World, a study of Kant's philosophy of history and politics, published in 1986. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Political Theories continues. My guest now is Charles Kessler of Claremont McKenna College. Charles Kessler is the editor of Saving the Revolution, the Federalist Papers, and the American Founding, published by the Free Press in 1987. Here is Charles Kessler.
Basically, if the American Revolution can be understood as launching, as its proponents and its participants described it themselves, an experiment in self-government, then that experiment has not yet ended, because if we are governing ourselves or trying to govern ourselves, we are, in a sense, trying to prove that the revolution is still going on, that it is still possible to govern yourself as free men, not to resign your self-government over into the hands of either the few in a sort of administrative or bureaucratic state, or resign it over into the hands of a passionate majority.
Help me with the language in the Federalist. We want to govern ourselves. How is it by action and by choice rather than succumbing to outside forces? Give me the precise language there.
By reflection and choice rather than by accident and force.
All right. Well, how would you typify the course of American politics, if not in a practical sense, in a larger theoretical sense over the past couple of hundred years?
Well, that's a good question. There are many grand theories of American politics, you might say. Perhaps the most famous of them these days is the one that originated with Charles Beard and goes by the name of the economic interpretation of American politics.
Now, this is a 19th century historian.
This is an early 20th century
historian.
Yes. His famous book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, was published in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
According to him, all the reasons given in the Declaration of Independence, in the Federalist Papers, and so forth, to justify the revolution were essentially not reasons at all, but rationalizations. And they were rationalizations for the economic interests of the founders as a class. And according to him, the dynamics of American history ever since then are basically a form of the class struggle between those who have a lot and those who don't have a lot, mm-hmm. or between the few and the many, broadly speaking. That is one way of looking at American politics, but I don't think that really does justice to the innermost character of our politics, the truest character of our politics.
And what might that be?
That, I think, although of course economics is a part of politics, it isn't all of it. And really, the American experiment in self-government is essentially a moral experiment, I think. It asks the question, if you allow majorities to make laws within the constitutional framework, will these majorities make laws that are just or unjust? Because obviously, except for the restraints of the Constitution, which are not unimportant in this connection, it's up to us to determine our political destiny. But it isn't written in the stars anywhere that 51% of the people are going to be right all the time.
Let me stop you, Charles Kessler. Isn't that just a little naive to say that it's a moral experiment rather than an economic one? Doesn't politics come down to having money to do things? That is to say, being able to go to special interest groups and raise money for your own political agenda, get yourself elected, and therefore brag about your track record. I understand what you're saying. The tension, on the other hand, is putting more money into the hands of more people so that they can, in effect, see that moral mm-hmm. dimension and see beyond the dollar sign. But in practical terms, aren't we really talking about the dollars, the bottom line kind of thing?
Well, in a certain sense, economics, as I say, is an inescapable part of politics, but it isn't a determining part of politics, it seems to me. Centuries ago, after all, Aristotle said that men come together in political life for the sake of life, that is, for self-preservation and, you might say, economic advancement, but that they stay together for the sake of the good life, that is, some vision of what human happiness, human flourishing requires of them. And if you look at the careers of America's greatest politicians, I think you see there the way in which the economic questions and the questions of self-interest, let us say more generally, because obviously a politician's self-interest is not necessarily economic. He wants to get elected and re-elected. You can see that self-interest is a legitimate, but it seems to me ultimately a subordinate part of the drama of our political life. Take, for example, Abraham Lincoln, who I think everyone or most people would agree to be the greatest of our presidents.
Well, what have you written here? The essential American.
Yes, I think he is still the quintessential American. Uh-huh. He expresses even more than Washington or Jefferson or any of the founding generation what it is to be an American in terms of character. The combination of traits that he has really still defines what, to us and maybe even to most of the rest of the world, America can be at its best. But in any sense, the political struggles that he underwent in his career were obviously had an economic component. That is to say, he had to assemble first the Whig Party and then the Republican Party behind him. He had to defeat other candidates within the Republican Party sometimes. And above all, he had to win a majority or at least a plurality of the votes in a free election with Democratic opponents. To do this, he had to please the members of his coalition, his electoral coalition. But what he showed our politics to be was more than simply an attempt to pander to the economic interests of the coalition. There's some amount of that that has to be done. But also, it's up to statesmen and to politicians to set the terms of the debate, to explain to people what it is that they themselves really want if they thought it through. But even the Civil War and the success of Lincoln's policies and the Republican policies on civil rights and other things after the 1860s, that was made possible, it seems to me, only by the fact that at the founding of the United States, all men had been declared to be equal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was admittedly, in many ways, an ideal.
It was also
and still is
ever so slightly hypocritical, was it not, that we had a class of people creating the country, creating the political experiment, who had to survive themselves, and yet whose what brighter side envisioned this large, noble goal of equality?
Well, that's an acute question, and it's one that was widely debated in 1858. In fact, in the debate between the famous debates between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas, that's exactly what Douglas said to Lincoln. He said to him, look, if the Founding Fathers had really meant to declare that blacks were the equal of white men, how could they have kept their slaves? Mm-hmm. Did not that make them hypocrites? To which Lincoln's answer was, not at all. They were not in a position to free their slaves very easily, much less to emancipate slaves generally. But they were in a position, he said, to declare the principle, to declare the right that all men ought to be free and equal. That there's a difference between the principle behind the Constitution or the Bill of Rights and or the Civil War amendments, and how far you can live up to those principles immediately. So, for example, in the 14th Amendment, it is a fact of history that the same Congress that passed the 14th Amendment, calling for the equal protection of the laws to all citizens of the United States, that same Congress also passed a law segregating the schools in the District of Columbia. Now, over which it had jurisdiction.
Oh, goodness.
Does it therefore follow that the 14th Amendment could not be used as it was used to some degree in Brown v. Board of Education and in subsequent cases?
No, it doesn't
follow. To strike
follow.
Down no, segregation.
Not at all.
It would follow if you took the narrow historical view of original intent, but it wouldn't follow, it seems to me, if you took the proper view, which is that the principle contained in the amendment, even though it couldn't immediately be realized, mm-hmm. is still valid 100 years later.
Charles Kessler, let's talk a little bit about the teaching and the doing of American political history. Here at the Humanities Center, we have lots of conferences and seminars, and my suspicion is that the general public might look at this and say, whoa, we have more tempests in teapots. Again, what's at stake in the teaching, the writing, the doing of American history? We have factions on the left and the right, and we have ideological threads to follow. Trace some of that for me.
Well, the question at issue here is how we understand ourselves and what we understand the nation as a whole to be for. What is it to be an American? I mean, after all, it's easy to answer the question, what is it to be a Frenchman? Mm-hmm. Or what is it to be an Englishman?
Maybe the French or the English wouldn't agree with that.
Well, but it means something different, because primarily to be a Frenchman is someone to be born in France or born of a French family or someone born into the French culture and speaking especially the French language.
And here you're talking more about all of this pluralism and diversity.
In the United States, we come from all sorts of different ethnic stocks. We represent all different sorts of religions. There are more Muslims in the United States now than there are Presbyterians, for example. But it doesn't mean that all of these differences in race and religion and nationality and so forth means that the question, what is an American, changes with every generation. There is still a definition of what it is to be an American, which is represented above all by a dedication to certain ideas, mm-hmm. To certain principles. And that's what I was talking about earlier as the moral dimension of American politics.
Do you think the American electorate, the American populace, has that sense, conceives of itself in that respect? I mean, we could single out pockets of people, Italian pride or ethnic pride, this sort of thing. Is that what you're after, really?
Not really. I mean, what happened, this assertion of ethnicity, which happened began to happen in the late 60s and 70s, was in a certain way a gesture of protest against the amalgamating tendencies, you might say, of American national politics. And to that extent, I don't object to it. But what we shouldn't allow, it seems to me, is the sense of being an Italian American or a Jewish American or a black American to eclipse the fact that Italian, Jewish, black are modifiers of American.
Right.
And if we don't know what it is to be an American, then it makes no sense at all to speak of us, of anyone, as a black American or a Jewish American or a Baptist American, so far as that goes. That's the question that's being fought over in the state houses of the land when it comes to the adoption of textbooks and the approval of curriculum.
Is our diversity going to be our failing? Is our pluralism going to be our final weakness?
Well, it could be. Certainly in a very concrete sense, the excessive pluralism of the Roman Republic, led to its decay into the empire and eventually led to the overthrow of the empire as well. It isn't fashionable anymore to make comparisons between Rome and America, I realize, but it still seems to me that that, as a general diagnosis, is true. We have to remember that the American motto is A Pluribus Unum, from many one. And certainly there is no reason at all to consider pluralism unhealthy in America, so long as from that many we can still deduce the one, the American. And that, it seems to me, that is, we still have basically a very healthy country, and I don't think we're in danger of losing that sense of Americanism. You can see it rekindled every 4 years to some degree in the emotionalism generated in our political campaigns and sometimes in the Olympics and other events that evoke a national spirit.
Charles Kessler teaches at Claremont McKenna College. Charles Kessler is the editor of Saving the Revolution, the Federalist Papers, and the American Founding, published by the Free Press in 1987. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 432. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about literature in the 19th century American South and about contemporary American fiction. My guests will be Marianne Wimsatt of Southwest Texas State University and Elizabeth Spencer, a novelist who teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. In June and July of 1989, the National Humanities Center will sponsor seminars on two topics, literature and its audiences and the concept of republicanism. These enrichment programs are for high school teachers of literature and history. For an application, write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The deadline for applications is March 1, 1989. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in January marks an anniversary for the Battle of New Orleans, in which General Andrew Jackson defended the city against British troops in January 1815. Jean-Pierre Blanchard made the first manned balloon flight in America during the second week in January 1793. The American philosopher William James and the American writer Jack London were born during the second week in January, William James in 1842, Jack London in 1876. And the founder of the Fuller Brush Company, Alfred Carl Fuller, was born during the second week in January, 1885. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Politics in Theory and Practice, this week on Soundings. Listen for James Booth of Duke University and Charles Kessler of Claremont McKenna College. James Booth is the author of Masters and Servants, Reflections on Marxism and Its Origins. Charles Kessler is the editor of Saving the Revolution, The Federalist Papers and the American Founding. Politics in Theory and Practice, this week on Soundings.